The headlines this hour: the U.S. President Joe Biden accuses Russia of weighing the use of biological and chemical weapons in its military operation in Ukraine. Russia halts peace treaty talks with Japan, citing Tokyo's unfriendly positions over the conflict in Ukraine. And anti-government protests rising in France ahead of the upcoming presidential election. Thanks for joining us. U.S. President Joe Biden once again accusing Russia of considering the use of chemical weapons in Ukraine. Biden says that President Vladimir Putin's back is against the wall. According to the U.S. president, Russia is now setting up false flags in preparation for using chemical weapons. Biden says these include Moscow's allegation that Kyiv has biological and chemical weapons, but has not offered any proof to back his claims. Moscow says it has evidence of Washington helping Ukraine make chemical weapons in BioFair labs near the Russian border, but the U.S. denies that. Political analyst Barry Grossman believes it is the U.S. that could be planning a false flag chemical attack in Ukraine to blame Russia.
The main difference between what is unfolding now in the Ukraine and what took place in Syria being that the speechwriters for Biden are a little bit more clever in that they're saying in advance that they're anticipating a false flag, which in fact it's a sort of double false flag scenario, all of which is nonsense, as is the notion that the Russians have their back against the wall. They've been executing a very limited military operation with very key objectives in mind. It's not like all of the Ukraine is caught up in some kind of a conflagration of war. The Russians can turn up the heat. They don't need to resort to things like chemical weapons. There's no evidence that Russia has any intention to use chemical weapons, and there's no need, and it certainly wouldn't help Russia's position in the slightest. If there is anything to be concerned about, it's the possibility that this claim foreshadows an intention on the part of the Americans and the usual suspects now, including the Ukraine, to stage a false flag using chemical weapons and blame Russia.
Russia says it has broken off peace treaty talks with Japan because of Tokyo's unfriendly position against Moscow over Ukraine. Russia says that it does not intend to continue the negotiations under the current conditions. The move has drawn a reaction from Japan, with Prime Minister Fumio Kishida calling it completely unacceptable. Japan has recently imposed a series of sanctions on Russian financial institutions and exports. The two countries have not signed a peace treaty since World War II due to a territorial standoff over a set of islands. Russia also says that it has withdrawn from talks over joint business projects on the islands and ended visa-free travel to the territory for Japanese citizens. The Ukrainian president has called on European leaders to cease all trade with Russia to pressure Moscow into halting its nearly month-long military offensive against his country. Volodymyr Zelensky pleaded with the Europeans not to sponsor Russia's weapons of war. Elsewhere, Zelensky said that any compromises agreed with Russia to end the conflict must be put to Ukrainians' vote in a referendum. Zelensky once again insisted on meeting with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, saying the meeting was necessary to end the conflict. The Ukrainian defense minister also said that Russia is conducting state terrorism in Ukraine and will go on to attack other countries. The U.S. says nearly 3.5 million Ukrainians have fled the country since the beginning of Russia's offensive on November 24. Meanwhile, a Russian court on Monday banned Facebook and Instagram, labeling their parent company Meta an extremist organization. The two social media giants are already banned in Russia. The EU takes a major step forward in establishing its own army against the backdrop of the conflict in Ukraine. EU foreign and defense ministers have adopted the so-called strategic compass, which will involve a huge increase in military spending. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
At present, the 27 nations in the European Union spend 1.5% of their economic output on weapons and troops. That is about to increase significantly because EU ministers meeting in Brussels have just adopted their strategic compass following 2 years of negotiations.
Today, the military expenditure in Europe of all member states adding up, it's about 200,000 million euros. We have to spend more.
In his press conference, Borrell highlighted that combined EU nations already spend four times more than Russia on military capabilities. But that is still not enough, he said. He insists the bloc's military plan will not undermine NATO. Many analysts say there's no doubt that it will. But that's not a bad thing, as NATO is driven by an aggressive US foreign policy, they suggest. Foreign and defence ministers are in the process of creating an EU army. They say the conflict in Ukraine proves the importance of such a move. When opinion polls are carried out, most citizens always agree they don't want more money being spent on war machines.
The more we put and focus energy on something wrong like war, you know, it increases the chance that war is coming to us.
I just think it's to make the people feel safe, but I don't really think it will change anything, so I think they should spend money on something different.
There is also resistance to the huge amounts of money being spent by the 30 countries that make up the NATO military alliance.
My party and my political friends, we want that Germany goes out of NATO. We want to bring Russia into Europe because Russia is a part of Europe and the United States are far from Europe.
NATO and EU leaders will hold summits later this week here in the Belgian capital. Peace activists are calling for greater diplomatic efforts by them to end the bloodshed in Ukraine. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
In France, anti-government protests are becoming a regular occurrence less than 3 weeks before the presidential election begins. French households are being slammed by inflation, spelling difficulties for incumbent politicians. Ramin Mazahari has more from Paris.
Since late last week, France has seen nationwide anti-government protests almost every day. March 17th's protests were over better pay and working conditions. March 19th saw the yellow vests and protests against state-sponsored Islamophobia and racism, while March 21st saw the record price of gasoline cause taxi drivers, truckers, fishermen, and others to protest nationwide. President Emmanuel Macron has joined the European Union's unprecedented sanction drive against top energy supplier Russia for its military operation in Ukraine, regardless of the economic costs on the average French household. The price of petrol has crossed the psychological barrier of 2 euros per liter, creating inflation in goods across the board. Those on low and fixed incomes are now being told to make sacrifices by politicians who may be living far more comfortable lifestyles.
Moi, je pense qu'ils souffrent vraiment.
I think that people are really suffering. Unfortunately, this doesn't mean much to our leaders. There are elderly people who live off canned sardines, if not canned cat food. French politics is 30 years behind where it should be. And if it doesn't change, there might be a civil war here.
Adding to the hardships being asked of the average French voter, Macron recently announced that if reelected, he will raise the retirement age to 65. That has caused the left-wing candidate, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, to jump in the first-round polls to third place, but he still trails the far-right's Marine Le Pen by several points.
They aren't even talking about inflation in the election campaign. For everyone in France, it's big news, but not to our candidates. Everyone who isn't rich is wondering if the energy price increases are ever going to stop, while the poor wonder if they are ever going to be targeted by government aid.
While inflation has soared, it's not like this is a new problem for the average French person. Despite long-time official claims of low inflation, reduced purchasing power has been the number one issue for voters in 2017 and 2012 as well. There will be at least two more days of nationwide protests this week. France's first-round presidential vote is now less than 3 weeks away. Many are saying that the final days of Macron's five-year term are ending in a typical fashion, full of anti-government protests. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
The charity organization has found a, quote, shocking trend of people of color paying a lot more for car insurance in the UK. It says that they are paying hundreds of pounds more in premiums than white customers. Citizens Advice said its year-long investigation has uncovered that on average, people of color are paying at least £250 more than white people to insure their vehicles. It said the so-called ethnicity penalty is up to £950 in some locations. The charity said in some areas, the difference in price was more than 100%. It said the difference cannot be accounted for by common risk factors such as crime rates and deprivation levels. The charity urged an investigation into the issue. However, the UK's main insurance industry trade body disputed the report's conclusions, saying that insurers never used ethnicity as a factor when setting prices. Saudi Arabia impounds yet another emergency fuel ship bound for Yemen amid a deteriorating humanitarian crisis there. The Yemen Petroleum Company says the ship en route to the port city of Hodeidah was seized on Monday. The vessel was detained despite being searched and holding entry permits from the UN. Two other ships were seized earlier the same day. The Saudi-led coalition has held dozens of ships over the past 1.5 years, blocking Yemen's much-needed fuel imports. The humanitarian situation is deteriorating in Yemen due to an all-out Saudi blockade. Much of Yemen's vital sectors, including hospitals, as well as electricity and water services, have already come to a halt. According to the UN, more than 23 million people now need assistance. That accounts for about 3 out of every 4 people. Among them are 19 million who will go hungry in the coming months. The Yemeni army has released details of its retaliatory attacks, including the latest operations dubbed Breaking the Siege. Those attacks have hit targets in Saudi Arabia and its allied countries in the ongoing war in Yemen over the past 7 years.
The Yemen hurricane was also launched, and the break of the siege operations were also launched. The total of sum of killed and wounded of the enemy, 275,143 wounded or killed from human casualties, the Saudi 10,759, the Emiratis 1,251, the Sudanese 9,440, and the mercenaries that were also the Yemeni mercenaries and Yemeni traitors, 253,693.
Yahya Sari said the Yemeni people have remained resilient and steadfast in the face of the Saudi war. He said the Yemenis are capable of defending the sovereignty of the country against any acts of aggression. Sari said that the army will continue its retaliatory operations until the Saudi-led war stops. The war began in March 2015. Saudi Arabia and its allies also imposed an all-out blockade on Yemen. The blockade, coupled with daily airstrikes, has worsened the humanitarian situation in Yemen, where tens of thousands have died as a result. Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, once again stresses that the country's economy should not be tied to U.S. sanctions. Ayatollah Khamenei said while the sanctions removal should be sought, the country must be run in a way that restrictions cannot harm its economy. The leader said that national production is an important factor also. Plus, he added domestic economy should be knowledge-based. Ayatollah Khamenei was addressing the Iranian nation on the occasion of the Persian New Year. The leader also touched upon the Ukraine conflict and how it revealed what he called the blatant racism rampant in the West. He criticized Western countries for their double standards in dealing with white and black refugees. Ayatollah Khamenei also slammed the West for blackmailing independent countries by exploiting the concept of human rights. Kevin Barrett is an author and Middle East expert. He says Iran's efforts to have a resistance economy have been successful and explains why the country has chosen such a policy.
The Iranian economy has survived the most brutal long-range series of sanctions ever. Although just in the past month or so, it's been eclipsed by the even harsher sanctions on Russia. But of course, those have only been in effect for a few weeks. And Iran's been suffering under various forms of sanctions, essentially ever since the Islamic Republic was created in 1979. Well, the sanctions on Iran have failed. in some respects, of course, they have inflicted terrible suffering on some people in Iran by keeping out needed medicines, things like that. But they've also acted as tariffs, and they've encouraged Iran to develop its own industries. And Iran has had rather astonishing success at that, given the unending economic and even, you know, terroristic hostilities directed against it. So I think the leader is on the right track by saying that it would be nice to end the sanctions, but it's also critically important for Iran to remain on this track of a resistance economy that can continue to thrive even with sanctions, because the Americans, as Putin has said, are non-agreement capable, as we saw when the Obama's deal on the JCPOA was trashed by the Trump administration, and now Biden wants it back.
It has been almost a year since negotiations to revive the 2015 Iran deal started in Vienna. Now the U.S. says that it is ready to make difficult decisions to return Iran's nuclear program to limits that have been set out in the landmark accord. State Department spokesman Ned Price says one of the remaining issues for the U.S. is Iran committing to verifiable limits on its nuclear activities, in return for an easing of sanctions. Price said the agreement is neither imminent nor close, and that Washington is preparing equally for scenarios with or without a mutual return to the deal. Tehran is demanding the removal of U.S. sanctions in a verifiable manner, as well as guarantees that any possible agreements will ensure sustained economic benefits for the country. The senior Iranian cleric Ayatollah Mohammad Mohammadi Reshari has passed away at the age of 76. Ayatollah Reshari had been hospitalized in Tehran in recent days due to an illness. He was the first Iranian intelligence minister after the 1979 Islamic Revolution. He also served as the prosecutor general, as well as a member of the Assembly of Experts for two terms. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has in a message offered his condolences on the passing of the cleric. And that is for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Congratulations to all Iranians and everyone who celebrates the ancient festivity of Nowruz. On behalf of myself and all my colleagues here at IRIB English Radio, we wish you a wonderful Nowruz, full of happiness and prosperity.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, today we are going to continue discussing Imam Khomeini's views on armed forces. This time we will focus on the Imam's cautioning of the armed forces against entering political disputes in the country. First, we will give you a general view of armed forces' role in political affairs. Stay tuned, please. Safeguarding territorial integrity and establishment of internal order are the two major duties of armed forces in all countries. However, historical experiences have shown that armed forces have wielded their power for political purposes and transferring power. In such countries, armed forces have played significant roles in political developments. In many cases, they have tried to repel political parties in a bid to turn into the dominant power in the political arena. The interference and influence of armed forces in politics is an index to show how much a ruling system is democratic. Some theorists name two models for militarism and interference of armed forces in politics. The first model is direct interference of armed forces in politics, and the second one is the culture of militarism and discipline as a pattern of dominance and obedience in people's social life. Considering the fact that militarism leads to admiration of war-mongering views in society, it is called as a political and social ailment. Interference of armed forces in politics can be seen in many types of ruling systems. Roosevelt and Eisenhower were two of the American presidents who caused the U.S. armed forces dominate politics. Napoleon Bonaparte of France, too, caused the army dominate people's political and social life to the extent that the military were given the mission to make domestic order and social coherence. The theorists who are concerned about armed forces meddling in politics call professionalism of them as an effective way to overcome the problem. They maintain that armed forces meddling in politics has decreased in advanced societies because these forces are engaged in their specialized military affairs. Hence, they let politicians play their own role of administering the affairs of government. Before the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, Reza Khan founded Officers' Faculty in 13100, decreased military budget to one-third while increasing the military four times, that is 150,000. Therefore, the military controlled power in the country, as Reza Khan himself was a low-ranking military officer who had seized power through coup d'etat. Militarism and interference of armed forces in politics reached its climax during the rule of Reza Khan's son, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, especially after the 1964 coup. In the post-coup era, particularly in the 60s and 70s, the number of the military increased to 400,000 from the previous 120,000. In view of this, during 5 years, $6 billion were spent for arms purchase. During the struggles of the Islamic Revolution, there was a public demand of preventing the military from interfering in politics. Imam Khomeini repeatedly explained this point in his speeches. In his testament, the Imam strongly prevented the armed forces from interfering in political parties and insisted that this would guarantee the military power of armed forces and their popularity. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, writes in his testament, "My emphatic enjoinment to the armed forces is that just as one of the regulations of the system is non-interference of the military in parties, groups, and fronts, they should practice it, and the armed forces, including the military, the police, IRGC, Basij, and others, should not absolutely enter any party and group, and should keep away from political games. Thus, they can keep their military power and be immune from intra-group differences. And it is incumbent upon commanders to prevent the individuals under their command from entering parties." Dear listeners, next time we will continue the discussion.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei has talked on the occasion of the Persian New Year one day after he issued his Nowruz message, which he designated the Persian New Year as the year of production, knowledge-based, and job-creating. He reiterated this slogan, in which he said the economy should not be tied to U.S. sanctions. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will examine the different aspects of Iran's leader's speech, like the economy, and also review his views on the conflict in Ukraine and U.S. double standards on human rights. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Joining us is Hakimeh Birin, the Assistant Professor of Islamic Knowledge and Thoughts from the University of Tehran. Also joining us, Sayyid Mostafa Khoshesh, political commentator, both joining us from Tehran.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both. Hakimeh Birin, I apologize, I said Birin. Let me first come to you with this question, and I welcome you both. We're looking at the slogan that I'd like to ask from you, since it's very important, obviously, as Iran's leader has stated, production, knowledge-based, and job-creating. And he has stated production
to be the center of really the messages behind his economic, I guess, theories as presented in his speech. What is your take on what he has meant by production, knowledge-based, and job-creating?
As you know, Ayatollah Khamenei has been having economics-based slogans for several years now. If I want to put that into context, I should say that it is related to the idea of independence from his perspective, in his viewpoint, and from the viewpoint of Imam Khomeini. What is independence? How is Iran able to achieve independence? In order for Iran to achieve independence, Iran has to go through several stages. The first of which is achieving the ideological structure of independence. The idea that, yes, we want to be independent from the system of dominance that is running the world, and that we can do that. So Iran was able to do that through the Islamic Revolution, through the victory of the Islamic Revolution. The second stage is strengthening the system from within, strengthening the country from within. And one of the most difficult aspects of that is the economic aspect, because of the system of dominance that has been running the world for the last 500 years or so, you know, first through a colonial system and then through the dual system of the Cold War and then through the American-centered system of dominance, the world, countries around the world are having a difficult time to be independent economically, which is one of the requirements for them to be able to actually have independence in other aspects and actually be able to prosper in the way that they want, in the way that they see, prosperity and progress, mm-hmm. not in the way that the so-called global powers want them to see it. So in order for Iran to be strong from within, we need to focus on the economy. And one of the best ways to achieve economic strength is through, knowledge-based approach to economics and to running the economy of the country. So okay. I think this is what the significance of this slogan is, that there is no other way that Iran can achieve real independence other than it can have a strong economy from within.
Sure. The independence part of your statements there is also contributing to a lot of other ripple effects in the economy based on that, which we will hopefully get into a little later on. Say, Mostafa Khoshesh, from the outside looking in, people are going to wonder, what does knowledge-based economy mean? Because Iran's leader has said to move forward with this knowledge-based economy, an economic system where knowledge plays a vital role in all fields of production, is how he addressed it. But the knowledge-based economy phrase, if you can explain to us what that means, at least for us to get a better idea here.
Alan, thanks for having me. As Professor Birria said, this is a very important point that was touched by the leader in this year's message, as well as messages in the past few years. It's part of independence of Iran and growing into a regional and world power. You need to develop your hard power, as well as your semi-hard and soft power. Since Iran had the revolution back in 1979, it was under much pressure by foreign threats, from the imposed war by former dictator Saddam Hussein to sanctions, as well as attempts for staging coup d'etats. Iran has been under much threat by hard power, military power, political power, by enemies. Therefore, in reaction, it has developed its power in this specific area. So it has a very robust military power, not only in the region, but also it's one of the best Now, of course, globally speaking, it has a very effective and robust missile power, drone power. But now the threat of enemy, I mean, especially the United States, has changed in nature. For the past one or two decades, they've been using their economic power to undermine Iran and its power. And they've also been using soft power to undermine the Islamic Republic of Iran. So you need to develop the same kind of power that, you know, about the kind of experience that we had in the past two decades in economic areas as well as in soft areas. Now, Iran has, you know, developed a very effective, Iran has effectively grown its, you know, different sciences, branches of science, like in nanotechnology, in stem cell technology, in aerospace technology, satellite technology, and in nuclear technology. And then as far as knowledge and science and technology is concerned,
right.
Well, Iran is one of the pioneering powers in these all these areas. But when it should be interpreted into business, into economic benefit and interest, there is a missed, you know, there is a gap and the chain and the ring is lost in there. I mean, Iran is very much powerful in area of nanotechnology, but when it comes to making benefit and becoming, you know, economically speaking, a global power in this specific branch or in area of satellite industries or satellite launch industries or in many other areas like stem cell technology, then you see that Iran is not using this kind of branch of science for becoming a global economic power. This is the chain. I mean, there's a chain and this part is missed. So this is a very important problem that we need to, you know, solve. And the Iranian leader was tasked with you know, larger scale and strategic planning for the country based on the constitution, he is now drawing attention that in future, from now on, when we are talking about economy, we should not just talk about consumption, we should not talk about farming or industries generally. We need to have a well-detailed plan based on those areas that we are pioneering in science and technology. And we can become one of the global powers in these areas, sure, including nanotechnology, stem cell technology, and so on and so forth. Sure. So he's speaking of strategic planning for the country to become, you know, globally semi-hard, you know, powerful country, or more specifically, an economic power in the region and the world in coming decades. Mm-hmm. And he's drawing a plan to do that based on those sciences and technologies that we've been able to make major breakthroughs.
Sure. And I'd like to just add something to it in terms of an observation from me, since I am not an economist, nor am I even familiar with this, but based on the insight you've given us, Sayyid Mostafa Khoshesh, my overall perception is that there needs to be, in whatever sector that Iran wants to make advancements, that it needs to be up-to-date technologically in order for the question which I'm going to ask our guest, Hakim Abiria, in order to focus on, for example, the production aspect of the statement and the slogan from Iran's leader. And Ms. Hakim Abiria, you talked about independence. Independence is something that Iran can pride itself because it's been under sanctions for so many decades, really. And based on what Iran's leader has said, boosting domestic production is the sole way to achieve equitable progress in the economy. And he cited how that can overcome the problem of poverty in the country. So independence brings about domestic production, no matter what field it is. Can you give us the relationship there of the independence which you talked about before and how Iran's leader has focused on this boosting of the domestic production?
Of course, the idea is that when Iran went out of, brought itself out of that system of, you know, client-patron relationship with the United States, it was bombarded with a multi-layer hybrid system of pressure, which included an economic aspect. So Iran was not left on its own to prosper during the years after the revolution. So it has to have a special, policies in order to be robust internally, be strong internally, and be able to withstand all that pressure that is coming from the outside world, especially from the United States. The leader actually pointed out the fact that we have been under unprecedented pressure economically during the past decade. That idea, the phrase that has been used during the Trump administration and the policy that has been kept during the Biden administration, all the pressures that have been brought upon the Islamic Republic, it requires for us, in order to be able to prosper internally, to have a very specific focus on the health of the economy, on the policies that are taken in order to achieve the economic goals of the Islamic Revolution. And let me bring up another key word that was missed so far from the speech, today's speech. The leader pointed out that we are after an economy that is based on justice, something that has been missing in the world for the past couple of hundred years, because the systems that have been running the world, either communism or capitalism for that matter, both have missed having justice as a goal. There is no such thing as an economy that is based on justice. So the Islamic Republic is after something that is new to the world. So in order for us to be able to achieve that sort of independence, that we want to have an economy that is based on justice, we need to take very specific measures that, this year the slogan has been a knowledge-based economy that is going to be able to create jobs as well.
Okay, you need to break that open for us, Mostafa Khoshesh, and how that could relate to another core message or statement that Iran's leader made, and that is that the country's economy should not be tied to U.S. sanctions, where at the same time, simultaneously, he's also practically saying that it doesn't mean that we have to not strive for eliminating the sanctions, but we have to make sure that that's not tied to Iran's economy. Tell us how that can be done and the challenges that may be there and how Iran may overcome it. Sayyid Mostafa Khoshesh? Okay, it doesn't seem like we have him. Ms. Hakima Birya, that is one of the things that Iran's leader talked about. He was actually very pleased. He said one of the sweet moments of this past year was what you were talking about, how the U.S. admitted that its maximum pressure campaign had failed. So how can the country's economy not be tied to U.S. sanctions?
If I may bring up this idea that the United States is using sanctions as a pressure technique, and then at the same time is using negotiations as another pressure technique. So we are not seeing an either or scenario where we have pressure and then we have lifting of pressure. So the negotiations are there, but then all along during Republican presidencies and during the Democratic presidencies, we have heard from the U.S. Policymakers and from U.S. Government officials that the sanctions are going to be there, no matter what the results of the negotiations. In one way or another, even during the JCPOA, the United States did not lift primary sanctions. So Iran was still under sanctions even when the JCPOA was in effect. And that was how the United States kept Iran from benefiting from any of those things that were there in JCPOA that were in, the interests of Iran. So we have to realize this, and we have to be able to live with this reality. And the only way that we can do that is by becoming strong and by becoming independent from the system that is trying to keep the pressure on, no matter what.
Very well. Saymo Safa-Hoshesh, let's change the whole landscape of our conversation to another very different topic, and that is the statements made on the Ukraine conflict by Iran's leader. He said how he was surprised and how it revealed, not surprised, he said it revealed what he called blatant racism that he said was rampant in the West. And he pinpointed to how Western countries actually had this double standards in dealing with white and black refugees in reference to, I guess, the one particular incident where African students said they were facing racism on trains and on buses while trying to flee Ukraine. It was interesting that that is something that stood out for him in order to relay that to us during his speech.
You know, for decades, we were, I mean, critics of the United States and the Western hegemonic rule and civilization would say that the U.S. and the West is very much hypocritical when it comes to its so-called Western values, like democracy, human rights, and legitimacy, and then there were people who were not convinced, apparently, and they were saying that this is not the case. But ever since the Khashoggi case, this hypocrisy, this exercise of double standards has become very much evident. Even Americanophiles would never defend the Western, the West in this regard. After Donald Trump and Biden both ignored the butchery that happened at the Saudi consulate in Turkey, in Istanbul, in the case of Khashoggi. And they both said that economy and business matters more than, you know, the case. We've been witnessing an increasing number of events throughout the world, with Ukraine being one of the latest ones, that have all unveiled how hypocritical the West is. When they check not only for the color of skin, but also they say it out loud in the media that there is a difference between the Middle Eastern nations, the black or brown or yellow-colored people, and the white, and the blue and green-eyed people. They say it. They are not even shy of acknowledging and speaking about it. They always say in the media in the past month, ever since the Ukraine war started and there have been refugees, I've been talking about it increasingly and saying that you should never, the media, the intellectuals, as well as journalists and thinkers of the West, they address the Western nations and saying that you should not be indifferent because they are not Arabs, they are not Muslims, they are not, strangers. They are us, the white people, the green, blue-eyed people. So this is a very important notion because the Ukraine war, I believe, has exposed the very deeply rooted understanding and paranoia of the West with regard to the others. The others could be Muslims, Iranians, or even East Asian nations, or the black people. They are the others, and they just love and adore and want respect for their own people and nation. And that's a very, profound problem with the Western understanding of humanity.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. I wanted to squeeze in one more question, but we can't. But it was a pleasure, Ms. Hakime Birya, Assistant Professor of Islamic Knowledge and Thoughts from the University of Tehran. Sayyid Mustafa Khoshesh, thank you so much for your input, political commentator, both from Tehran. And that is for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Takhvay, the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host, Musa Al Bahadili, and you are now listening to the program Q&A on Islamic beliefs. Joining me in the studio today is a dear friend and esteemed guest speaker, Sheikh Murtada Karimi, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, I welcome you and assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Our question today, dear Sheikh, is a compared to recent questions, a very important one, because it deals also in an indirect way with our beliefs. Mm-hmm. It deals with who Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is. And the question, it is as follows. Why is it that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he punishes finite and limited beings and creatures such as ourselves with infinite and everlasting punishment? Is this compatible with Allah being described as just?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think this question is referring to the fact that, the number of our sins is limited. So we have, committed a couple of sins at the end of the day. But so the punishment might be 60 years of committing sins.
Right. But it is logically perhaps vastly out of proportion.
Exactly. So why we have everlasting punishment? A very important question and in need of referring to a couple of points. The first point is that sometimes it is raised by people who want to reject the religion of Islam. And maybe one question that may be asked is that why you do not say the same thing about good actions and paradise? For the good actions, we also do it like in 60 years.
Same concept.
Right. And then the reward is everlasting. So at least you may ponder over the fact that for paradise, which is a kind of manifestation of mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, it is the same. We have done good actions for a couple of years, but then the reward is everlasting.
Right.
Of course, we do believe that that punishment is also a part of the and manifestation of the mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Right.
The second point is that in the most cases, the punishments are for, a short time or a long time, but they are not everlasting.
Right.
The concept of khulud, eternity in hellfire, is only for very few.
Select few.
Yes.
It's actually very difficult to get khulud.
Exactly.
It's like an achievement, perhaps.
Exactly. And they are very few in number. So we shouldn't think that whoever goes to the hellfire will be there for eternity, for good. No. Those people who go to paradise, they will be there forever.
Right.
But as for the people who go to the hellfire, according to the verses and narrations, the majority of them, they will be purified after being punished for sometimes. It is different from one person to another based on their actions.
Additionally to what you were saying, Sheikh, infinity is a huge number we cannot understand. So even if you are, perhaps we say 100, 1,000 years in the hellfire, that is still going to be nothing in proportion to infinity.
That's the point, yeah. Now the main question is that, okay, but at the end of the day, there are some people who will be in the hellfire
forever.
Forever.
Right.
But our actions are limited in number. So is it fair? Is it based, in line with the justice of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala?
Right.
Now, the point is that, first of all, we have some verses in the Quran talking about khulud. There is no doubt about that. Khulud in paradise has no objection. No one arguing against Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Right. Seems Allah, you are too kind.
Yeah.
This isn't how it should be.
So it's very crystal clear that those people, the khulud, the eternity in the paradise is a mercy, and no one is objecting and arguing against that.
Right.
But when it comes to khulud, eternity in the hellfire, again, we have verses about that in the Noble Book of Quran and, of course, in the narrations. I will share some of them. But does it mean that all Muslim scholars believe in eternity in the hellfire?
There's a difference of opinion.
Yeah, may be surprised that when it is mentioned in the Quran, is there any difference of idea? The answer is that yes, we have some Muslim scholars who disagree with that. They are not against the verses of the Quran. They have another explanation. I don't want to say that I agree with them. No. In most of the cases, I do not agree with them. But I would like to mention their viewpoints.
Just for information sharing.
Exactly.
Right.
So when it comes especially to Islamic mysticism, the great Islamic mystics, and some of them we may call it Sufi, they believe that they have a special opinion regarding khulud and eternity. For example, the famous Ibn al-Arabi, who is one of the pioneers in Islamic mysticism, they do not claim, he and others, they do not claim that they will not be in the hellfire forever. No, they say that they are in the hellfire forever, but after some times of being punished, they do not suffer the punishments anymore. They enjoy being in the hellfire.
That is a very interesting viewpoint.
Yeah. It doesn't mean that they are enjoying that like the people of the paradise, but somehow they are getting used to those punishments. It's a kind of daily activity that we are getting used to that.
Interesting.
Yeah, this is my terminology, of course.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
So he said that after some time, when they are punished based on their actions,